don't frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on January 15th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, I interview Felix Biederman about Saudi Arabia, the role of social media there, the Saudi war in Yemen, and the future of U.S. alliances in the Persian Gulf region. All that and more is coming up just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me this week on the line from New York is Felix Biederman, who is the one of the co-hosts of Chapo Trap House podcast and has an article out recently on Deadspin.com that we're going to be talking about. Felix, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm good. So the article that you published at Deadspin, specifically The Concourse, the headline was "Your app isn't helping the people of Saudi Arabia." The past few months of the show, I've been mostly concentrating, I think for obvious reasons, on domestic politics, but longtime fans of the show know that this is essentially first and foremost actually a foreign policy show. So we're getting back into that. And your article is, it's a long read. I would characterize it as essentially following three major parts. So one is just the general history of Saudi Arabia, which actually isn't that long. Then it's kind of an indictment of modern Saudi Arabia as it exists right now and the policies. And then finally, as the title suggests, talking about the role that technology plays and how some of these sort of techno-utopian perspectives are pretty over the top, exaggerated. And in fact, rather than liberating Saudi Arabia, maybe contributing to ongoing enslavement, literally in some cases. So why don't we talk first about the tech angle that you focused on here? Because that seems to be a very popular thing these days, is to pitch everything as a tech angle. But you had an interesting spin on it here, which was, as I said, rather than saying that this was a positive for Saudi Arabia, it was in many ways exacerbating existing problems. It wasn't necessarily creating problems, but it was reinforcing current trends. So you, in this article, interviewed a whole bunch of people who were vulnerable within the Saudi society, which is a lot of people, and you interviewed how social media and those kind of tools played a role in their lives. What were some of the categories of people that you were interviewing?
It started out, I mean, the reason for the tech focus is that it started out as an entirely different article. It started out just being about this phenomenon that I would see when I would look at sort of Gulf Twitter in countries like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait. You know, these countries have an incredibly high rate of penetration as far as social media use because they're such closed societies and human beings are social creatures and we will find a way, no matter how totalitarian or restrictive our society is. But it started about that. I thought this was an interesting, terrifying phenomenon that these people who were, they were gay or they were lesbian or they were bisexual or they were atheist or even worse, they spoke out against, you know, the government or the worst thing you could be unconditionally, which is a migrant worker who complained about their working conditions and the political situation in Saudi Arabia, would be doxxed by these very big accounts in the Gulf. And I thought it was horrible that you could report these people to Twitter, but nothing would happen to these accounts that would dox, like, in many cases, kids there have definitely been people who have died because they've been doxxed on Twitter or some other social media platform because of who they are. You know, either they've been killed by the government, they've been killed in silence by their families in some cases, or in other cases, they essentially live out solitary confinement for the rest of their days, sort of restricted by their families or imprisoned. But the more that I talk to people who were attempting to hold on to some sort of anonymity online, speaking from Saudi Arabia, the more I got interested in their civic life and the civic society of Saudi Arabia, which is something we very rarely talk about. I know that I've talked with you about Saudi Arabia a lot, but we occupy a pretty small space, to be honest, because from the liberal perspective, Saudi Arabia isn't frequently discussed because it's seen as this necessary evil, this ally that we have that, yes, does fund some liberal think tanks such as Center for American Progress and the Brookings Institute, but it's seen as just, you know, something you worship at the altar of pragmatism, and never mind the awful things that happen to their citizens. It's just the worst type of cultural equivocation. But on the other side, the people who usually do critique Saudi Arabia as partially as you and I would are paleoconservatives. And unfortunately, when people come from that perspective, there's no real sympathy for the majority of people who live in this country. They are living in a totalitarian society, and they are incredibly vulnerable to all sorts of trauma and abuse and physical danger all the time, every hour of every day that they're there.
Now, I'm going to want to circle back later on in our discussion about the points you were just raising regarding sort of pragmatic or not pragmatic U.S. alliances. But I wanted to go back, though, to, you know, the groups that you were interviewing. You highlighted just now that, and this is highlighted in the article as well, that there's sort of a hierarchy where it can be fatally dangerous in all cases, whether it's someone who is gay and they're obviously can't be out publicly there, but they're maybe out online, or they are atheists, or, you know, have left the faith. And that is obviously very dangerous in and of itself. But you've emphasized that migrant workers are, I guess, treated on an even further subhuman level, if that's possible. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of the role that migrant workers play in Saudi Arabia? Where are they from, and how are they treated in terms of both offline and online that makes it the case that they're sort of the lowest rung of the totem pole there?
Sort of look back at the amount of foreign workers in Saudi Arabia. I mean, first of all, it's just an incredible amount of people. It's not as much as Qatar, which is about 90% of their population are foreign-born workers who are not citizens. With Saudi Arabia, it's about 33%, maybe more, of the population are migrant workers. They typically come from Southeast Asian countries, but also Pakistan, the Philippines, numerous other places. And they face a litany of abuses. Famously, I believe it was even Malaysia prohibited women from going to the Gulf for a little while because working as maids in GCC nations, they would get raped. And of course, there would be no prosecution of their rapists because they were typically, if not from the royal families, it often was, they were from rich and well-connected families, and it's very rare that a male citizen will get prosecuted for the rape of a non-citizen. Just existing can get a foreign-born worker thrown in jail. Just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, if you face a particularly capricious enforcement officer, whether they're a border agent or a customs agent, or worse yet, the religious police, the Mutuin. But, you know, if you want to guarantee that you're going to get doxxed or that you're going to be abused as a foreign worker, you complain that you haven't been paid for your labor, which is very often the case. There's very often these foreign laborers are just used as slaves and not paid, barely given food, barely given lodging, or to complain about the political situation. And when I started talking to foreign workers later on in the story, when I ran into some of those, I remember they would have these, you know, those ask.fm pages.
Yeah.
You would look on those, and it would typically be them anonymously, these foreign workers, kids of foreign workers, minors who are living in these in Saudi Arabia. They just sort of anonymously talking to other foreign workers or children of foreign workers, but there would be about, you know, 10 comments every day that would come from the Saudi Nash. You could tell they were coming from like Saudi men, and they didn't even talk to them like they were human. It was like they were rhetorically referring to a device that wasn't functioning. It was just some of the most disgusting I've ever seen there. Just threatening to like blow their identity, tell the religious police, tell the customs police, get them thrown in hock, get their parents executed just because they had the nerve to speak at all.
It seems to me it's sort of a 1,000 times elevated version of people in the United States attacking immigrants, whether undocumented or legally here. The whole, like, if you don't like it, then go home, or saying you should be grateful to have a job, that kind of thing. But this is, like, taken to a different extreme.
Yeah, a group of people that I spoke with were foreign workers from sort of Eastern Africa, and just the kind of like anti-black racism leveled at them was just kind of just incredible. I mean, I guess it shouldn't be. It's, you know, it's, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that something that exists in, you know, any country where you have a hierarchy. It's, I mean, I would characterize it as different from some of the American animus against immigrants, because immigrants often in America get blamed for taking jobs from the, you know, white working class, however you want to define that, or they get, you know, they pass them off on social ills. But Saudi Arabia, there is a consistent policy of importing a huge portion of its workforce that has existed since the 1930s, pretty much, and it's accepted. It's a conscious decision made by the hierarchy of the government, but you know, most of the people who are abusing these people are yelling at them on Twitter or whatever service. They're not doing so because they think that, you know, their job is in jeopardy or something like that. It's not. It's just that when you have such a rigidly hierarchical system with such explicit punishments, and you're so often explicitly reminded that, you know, as a Saudi man of a certain economic class, you have this incredible power, it probably just becomes very natural for you to want to enforce that whenever you can. It doesn't come from any place of this, you know, oft mocked term economic anxiety. It just comes from a place of almost pure hate.
Now, in the article, you had given some examples that, you know, if someone was at a party or something and their phone got seized in a raid by the religious police, then if they hadn't locked down their phone somehow or prevented it from automatically logging into their social media accounts, they might be exposed as the person who had posted various things. So obviously that is sort of a much darker side of these social media tools that have often been sold, particularly around the 2009 Iran protests or the subsequent Arab Spring protests, as being some sort of tool of liberation or democratization. But there are still these people who in the United States who seem totally oblivious to the role that technology actually plays in this country. And in many cases, that's because they're benefiting financially from a direct relationship, particularly in the venture capital community. There was this really infamous set of tweets that went around that you referenced in this article regarding Uber. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that kind of bizarre pronouncement was and how you think it's perhaps symptomatic of a wider attitude.
This set of tweets comes from a now newly relevant guy, Balaji Srinivasan, who's just one of these Silicon Valley snake oil salesmen that claims that you can fix everything if you have, like, you know, one of those apps that does laundry for you because it's going to change the world and change the way that people process things. He's Trump's pick to head the FDA, which is just
that's horrifying.
Incredible. I can't wait to see how that turns out. He's deleted the tweets. Things live forever. You can never truly delete them. But here's the kind of mind we're dealing with. When it was announced that Saudi Arabia was purchasing a stake in Uber, Balaji said, "Pretty amazing that on this one issue, at least, Austin is the reactionary and Saudi Arabia is the progressive." And then, "For decades, Saudis funded Wahhabism. Now, finally, they're officially endorsing something that the young of the region can get behind." You know, provided that the young aren't gay or the migrant workers or don't sign on for monarchism, you know, or if they're sufficiently religious. Those young are precluded from this, but, you know, it's something that the young of Saudi Arabia can support. And, you know, it also, the Saudis, who have just such famously limited resources, that can only either fund Wahhabism or Uber. It's one or the other for those guys. They're really tightening their belts. The famous lack of liquid assets, the Saud family.
Yeah, and of course, using this to bludgeon the city of Austin, Texas, which had voted in a referendum at the ballot box to say that these, you know, Uber-type companies couldn't just run roughshod over the local regulations and, you know, not pay taxes and things like that. And then in retaliation, these companies all pull out. The idea that this is somehow a good sign, I mean, you know, the people voted democratically, you know, after a considered referendum campaign, which is not something that's afforded, you know, in Saudi Arabia by any stretch. And yet there's somehow this is supposed to be the shining light and model.
Yeah, I also like I like the conceit. You sort of see the type of person that's fast-tracked in Silicon Valley. You know, just on this one issue, at least, Austin is more reactionary. I mean, look, Austin may be more progressive. One could say on the issue of, you know, not imprisoning people for no reason, not beheading bloggers and clerics, not just murdering the poorest people on Earth in airstrikes, but look, on ride-sharing. Like, why would you even say that? What you to say that, you would have to have just rewired your brain to root out any type of conscience or compassion for human beings. And you would just have to have this lizard brain idiotic focus on things like ride-sharing freedom.
Yeah, I don't know. On the other hand, it seems like there's been a definite trend in the last few months toward people just completely ignoring anybody's body of work or career or anything, as long as they say the one or two right things that, you know, people want to hear. I mean, that's a little off topic, but just thinking of all the people that in the aftermath of the election, by continuing to oppose Trump, despite all the terrible things they had done in previous administrations or working at the CIA or whatever, suddenly they're elevated as voices of reason. So maybe that's just the hip new trend at this point, is that everyone is going to be fast tracked through elite circles for just completely saying, well, setting aside all of the horrendous things, you know, we're going to say that this one aspect is the focus, which I think is ties into the sort of technocratic aspect, which of course Saudi Arabia is trying to import from Silicon Valley, as you talk about in this article as well, with the McKinsey report, the Vision 2030, and all the previous McKinsey reports that have been done, which is, you know, to look very, very narrowly and basically disregard all these terrible domestic issues that are not going away, and to just say, no, there's a right way of doing things, you know, and we can efficiently guide this process forward, which, to be honest, I mean, technocracy works quite well with the framework of an absolute monarchy, because they just give an order and then they also tell you where to stop the implementation so that you don't go too far. So it's, you know, I can see why the technocrats would gravitate toward a system that dispenses entirely with pesky democracy.
Just to tell the audience a little bit, if they're not familiar, Saudi Vision 2030 is one of the most hysterical grift jobs that a Western consulting agency has ever pulled off on a royal family. It's this hideous PowerPoint that Mohammed bin Salman, who is the deputy crown prince and the minister of defense of Saudi Arabia, and sort of rumored to be the power behind the throne of his elderly and rumored to be dementia-ridden father, King Salman. It's his plan to implement technocracy on Saudi Arabia, and it has all these goals that are like, you know, now in what is now a time span of 13 years between now and 2030, that Saudi Arabia is going to replace all its state revenue with non-petroleum revenue. That they're going to sell Aramco, which would be, no one really knows how much it's worth, but you would have to find somebody who's going to give you maybe $1.5 to $2 trillion in cash and stock and other ventures. And it just, it's hilarious. These are clearly ideas that Deputy Crown Prince Salman and people in his circle had, because they have no concept of money or anything. And so they think, yeah, of course, you can just sell the biggest oil company, probably the biggest corporation in the world. You just do that next year. And of course, we can just replace that revenue. We're going to replace the one thing our country makes with what? What do you? It's never described. But of course, they went through McKinsey, who has. They've fleeced more king and queens than anyone who's ever sold snake oil or pretended to be a cardinal or a lost heir to a throne throughout history. They've fleeced tens of millions, if not hundreds of, probably hundreds of millions of dollars from people like this just to make these abominable PowerPoints, idiotic presentations. But I think the idea of technocracy, like someone like Srinivasan, and they would prefer to live in a monarchy where they have the ear of the king and they could decree these technocratic things into action. But I actually think that the social tensions and historic social tensions that have ruptured very recently in Saudi history, that if you tried to implement this technocracy, you would have a lot of problems, a great deal of them.
Yeah, that it seems like it's reaching a boiling point. I mean, maybe that's I don't want to use the word optimistic because I think it's going to be pretty much total chaos when it finally does melt down.
Yes.
But it seems like that it's definitely on the potential horizon. Arsenal for Democracy will be right back from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD in just a moment. Stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. My guest this hour has been Felix Biederman. He's talking about his article at The Concourse on Deadspin.com. Your app isn't helping the people of Saudi Arabia. You know, something you were mentioning about, you know, the sort of being divorced from reality of like the one thing that they've been good at doing, which is producing oil, and trying to replace that money source. There have been some interesting developments in the last few years, especially with the price of oil having gone way down, which was that Saudi Arabia started having to, I think, dip into some of their savings. But the amazing thing was they were trying to find ways to cut the budget or reform the budget and subsidies and things like that, which is always a dicey proposition domestically, you know, and that would be an example of something where a technocratic reform ending subsidies on fuel is likely to trigger a revolution. So it's kind of hard to implement. But there is some stuff that they don't seem to be dialing back on the spending for. For example, the war in Yemen, which I've definitely been very critical of, that they seem to just be willing to pour immense resources into for no apparent reason and with very little concrete end goal in sight. You know, at the time that they went in, which I guess was probably, 2014 at this point, so almost 3 years ago, I think, if I'm remembering the timeline correctly. I don't remember if it was 2014 or 2015.
I think it was 2015. It was 2015. Yeah, it was March of 2015.
Right, yeah. So coming up on 2 years. At the time, you know, there was this apocryphal quote circulating. Who knows if it was real or not, but I think it was Nasser talking about back in the 60s how Yemen was his Vietnam. Because Egypt had tried to stage an intervention there. Now, an article that I had published, which there was supposed to be like a two-part thing. And so we had one that was just like, and this was at The Globalist where I work. There were supposed to be two parts to the article. So the first part was, this is insane. They're basically repeating the Iraq catastrophe of just going, you know, jumping in head first without any particular preparation and clearly no ability to actually win the war or do anything beyond the initial assault. And then there was a second part, which did not get published by Al Jazeera, because the first part did, but the as soon as the Qatari military went in, Al Jazeera spiked the second part. But the second part of the article was that I was hypothesizing that the reach goal for the Yemen war was that Saudi Arabia was going to actually win the war and retake control and put back in their sort of puppet government that they had put in the first place, but that their likelier goal, because they clearly don't seem to be doing that well militarily, is that they were just going to repartition Yemen, because Yemen has only been united since 1990, and the Saudi people had installed a southern government. They had previously shipped tremendous numbers of arms to southern, you know, rebel groups. Al-Qaeda groups are based in the south, although Saudi Arabia has a bit of a questionable relationship with them sometimes. And then
it's actually the only time they don't get pushed back is when KSA coalition troops are fighting alongside the
right
AQAP troops.
Right, which is a huge irony, because that's the main branch of Al-Qaeda that has actually been targeting Saudi Arabia instead of turning its attentions elsewhere. But the other thing too is that you had literally, like, outside the White House, people protesting with the old South Yemeni flags and stuff like that, and the all of the relationships between Saudi Arabia and people in Yemen seems to be with the southern forces and southern politicians. And I don't know if you had any thoughts on it, but I, you know, my speculation, especially once it became clear how militarily incompetent this operation was going to be, that their goal was just to shatter Yemen into as many pieces as possible, you know, or at least repartition it, because that was, you know, the Yemen doesn't have the natural resources, although it has a fair amount. It doesn't have the same level of resources, and it's incredibly poor, but it's also the same population, more or less, as Saudi Arabia, and it's right next door and has a lot of issues with Saudi Arabia. So, you know, that was my speculation on that, which I don't know. You know, some people, I think, thought I was being a little bit conspiracy theory minded there.
No, I agree with you. The Houthis are the most organized political force in all of Yemen, and looking at the kind of support they have, and looking at the support the Saudis have for their factions, it seems like it's the only logical outcome. You know, this is a very strange war. It's very uncharacteristic of Saudi behavior in foreign nations. If you go back and look at the history of them interacting with other regional conflicts, you know, Saudi Arabia has never really had a military. They have more of an internal protection racket, and the officer class of the military is more or less like a grander version of LinkedIn for middle-class men to make business connections. They originally did not plan this massive military presence in Yemen, but they kind of got their bluff called. What happened was that they, of course, requested Pakistani troops.
Yeah.
And
well, they announced, you know, that they had secured Pakistani troops, but they had not actually done that when they announced it.
What a great move. Just it's the same amateurism as somebody who has a garage band announcing that they have the venue already. But the prime minister punted it to the parliament, because, you know, who is going to put their name to that in parliament? Who is going to vote, yes, let's send our troops to fight this other nation's war? This is always a figure of speech that we have, that we're fighting someone else's war. But this would be literally, you are lending your army to a bunch of inbred cousins of each other. Fight this war that has nothing to do with Pakistan. So, of course, they didn't get those troops, and the Saudis sent their own woefully unprepared troops in. And while, yes, they deeply lacked in any infantry capability, but they have an air force, and the air force is kind of like, if you're in a country like Saudi Arabia, being an officer in the Air Force, being a pilot in the Air Force, that is the modern equivalent of being in the cavalry. That's where you go if you're nobility. So it's obviously very well-funded and very well-equipped with American-produced planes. While Saudi troops, and, you know, since the Saudi troops have just gotten annihilated there, they've hired billions of dollars of former Blackwater mercenaries, of former Colombian right-wing death squad members. But those guys can be as well-trained as you want them to be. They don't really have any impetus to die for the Saud family's opaque goals in Yemen. And you can have a great air force, well, a greatly equipped air force that's competent and uses American targeting technology and assistance and gets refueled by American jets, as the Saudi Air Force does. But it doesn't mean anything if you don't have good infantry. All it means is that you're going to kill tens of thousands of civilians, as they have deliberately done. America plays by some pretense of rules when we go to war, where we still end up killing a horrific amount of civilians. But the Saudis do not even pretend in Yemen. They will just directly bomb funerals on purpose, as they have done. But going back sort of to the cause and the impossible position that they're in the war, this war is seen as very much as Mohammed bin Salman's baby. He's a very young guy. He's 31. He was 29 when this war started, and he was basically running it. He and this former general of some group of Australian special forces that the Saudis hired are also running it. but he's doing it on behalf of the UAE. It's a bizarre thing, but they didn't want to be there in the way that they did. But and if you look at their history, if they would have a regional problem like this, they would do what they always did. They would fund sort of a separatist or some jihadist group in the region, like they did in Balochistan with Iran, like they did with the Taliban and the Haqqani group, like they did with Emirate of the Caucasus, in Dagestan and Chechnya. If they have a regional enemy, they're not going to send their military or their intelligence agents. They have this very established system. It's called Wahhabization. They give more guns and money to whatever group is most alienated, nearest to this regional problem that they have. They go, well, you're Wahhabist now, or you're Wahhabist adjacent now, to use some sort of internet parlance. And this is more money than you have ever and will ever see in your lives, because you're, you know, you're either this very poor Avar group in Chechnya, or you live in the Hindu Kush Mountains. You're from this very poor place. And it worked for them. It worked tremendously well for them. And it never really hit back at the Saudi royal family itself, who was doing this activity. This was a policy kind of established after 1979, because that's when the Saudi Grand Mosque was taken by forces with inside the country. This really weird group of guys who thought that their brother was the Mahdi. It was a strange thing. But this strategy works twofold, because after 1979, because not only do they get to hit at regional enemies for a pittance of money for them that they funnel through GID, their intelligence service, they also get to send who they see as the most dangerous to their regime, angry and extremely pious young men. They get to send them to Afghanistan. They get to send them to Bosnia. They get to send them to Chechnya. Now they get to send them to Syria. So they have this problem in Yemen, and this is the first time they've ever gone about things this way. You know, they were a bit active in the Gulf War, but it's not exactly like they were spearheading that war.
Right.
It's not like it was, you know, the Saudi aircraft firing down the Highway of Death. This is the first time that they've really done this in the modern age, and they are pretty woefully unprepared. And they can kill as many people as they want and blow up as many funerals as they want. But I agree with you. They have no capability to actually occupy this country with the troops that they have. The only path for them to sort of save face is going to be a partition. If they have the capability to do that, I don't know. If they have the wherewithal, if they have the attention span, if Mohammed bin Salman is canny enough to do that, I honestly don't know. But hey, we'll see.
I've also been just fascinated by the sort of contrasts in how the war in Yemen is covered versus how the war in Syria is covered. I mean, a lot of it is definitely to do with the media, the U.S. media's relationship and the British media's relationship with Saudi Arabia being much more positive than it probably should be. But I mean, it's nuts, because Yemen is a much larger population than Syria. You know, for all the attention put on the siege of Aleppo, you know, the entirety of Yemen is essentially under siege by equally, if not more horrifying, you know, air power and also ground forces. You know, the Saudi planes, as I've talked about on the show previously, have intentionally targeted water pipelines. They have blown up seaports that were able to bring in food. They have literally bombed United Nations food delivery pallets that were waiting to be distributed. You know, and this is all being done with U.S. assistance, which I think is remarkable for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, the United States does not have any particular direct interest in the outcome of this conflict. I mean, they've invented some particular
positively zero.
Yeah. But you know, they're actively providing the guidance assistance. They were, you know, resupplying munitions, which they should not have done. And the bizarre part is that not only will this chaos be actively detrimental to U.S. interests in the region, but there was much concern back in late 2014, early 2015, even before the Yemen conflict started, where the United States had announced that they had this coalition assembled that was going to fly all these air missions over Syria to combat ISIS. And you know, one by one, within a matter of days, if not weeks, all of these partners dropped out of the fight, and it ended up being, you know, 80 and then 90 or whatever percent of these bombing runs in Syria, which were not without risk, were being conducted by the United States alone without any assistance from, you know, Bahrain or the UAE or Saudi Arabia. And in turn, within a matter of months, they then roll these same exact air power forces, you know, and then ground forces into the conflict in Yemen. And the United States is actively assisting that, even though it's, you know, pulling any attention away. I mean, not that I'm particularly excited to have Saudi Arabia militarily intervening in Syria either, but, you know, it's sort of a remarkable balancing act that they've taken, like, they've ignored all direct U.S. interests in favor of saying, well, the paramount interest is preserving this relationship, which is not even that old, with Saudi Arabia, in favor of, you know, against all other comers. I mean, I think, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here when I'm talking to you, but there's this psychological thing going on where the United States is in this, like, warped thing with Iran that they can't break out of since, you know, 1979 again, and you know, Iran, which is a vastly larger population, also an oil producing region. I would argue that, you know, despite the obvious blockades on certain democratic aspects, it's akin to sort of the early American Republic, which is that you have the setup for a participatory government. And not everyone gets to participate, or not everyone gets to be candidates, but you could potentially then convert this subsequently to a full-blown democracy. There's a lot of common interests, you know, with especially the younger population in Iran, none of which is in common with Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, there's no, in my opinion, you know, despite the Iranian government's own controversial stuff, there is nothing in common at this point that the United States has with Saudi Arabia, and it, to my mind, would make a lot more sense to be realigned with Iran, even though Iran has its own problems, because I think that Iran is on the correct track toward eventual true republicanism and representative democracy, but for some reason the U.S. has locked itself in this fugue state since 1979, where they're just like, anything that they can do to align against Iran, except apparently destroying its original chief rival, the, you know, Iraqi government. Not that Saddam Hussein was great either, but, you know, that was sort of a bizarre move as well, which I guess is in its own way being repeated here. In their determination to do whatever against Iran, they're throwing any apparent U.S. interests out the window, and it's all about preserving this relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very interesting to listen how U.S. media talks about Iran and Syria. With Iran, these people sort of pride themselves on liberal values of investigation and sort of a graduated system through which you evaluate governments and civil societies. They'll just scream in your face about how authoritarian the government is, which they commit terrible acts against their people. They execute a horrific amount of people. The IRGC has an incredible amount of power over the Iranian society. But as you said, there are way more building blocks to an actual civic society in Iran compared to Saudi Arabia. There are significantly more freedoms that you have in Iran compared to Saudi Arabia. Again, not saying that it's a very good situation for many people over there, but you can see the path that one could take compared to Saudi Arabia, where you just sort of see a path. You only see this ending in absolute horror and chaos. With Syria, I think that we're in this very strange mindset that we were as a culture, Western culture, was before World War I, where we thought that we believe that there's this right way to do war. I think because of low salaries in media careers for a while, and the how taking unpaid internships, the only people who can take media careers are often people from upper and upper middle classes. And because of social stratification and wealth stratification in the last 30 years in America, if you're upper middle class, is, you know, I grew up upper middle class. It took me a while, you know, until I was like 17, that I knew people who'd fought in wars, and I had a weird adolescence where I sort of like went outside the socioeconomic group I was born in, as far as people I was friends with. Other people who take, you know, the Ivy League or sub-Ivy, you know, unpaid internship, go to media, they probably barely have never been friends with someone who's fought in war. So they grow up with this idea of war that they get from movies, but also from Democrats. These are very often Democrats, and they get this idea that there is a moral way to conduct war. It is done by liberal interventionists. Everyone else does it wrong. That when you show them, you know, I remember during the siege of Madaya in Syria, I got in an argument with this liberal media guy, and he said, this is, you know, how can you say that we can't strike Hezbollah after seeing these pictures from Madaya? And I said, this is why war is bad. This is why I am against war, because sieges happen in every war, and they're brutal and terrible and starve people to death. Do you think that if we went into Syria, we wouldn't be besieging towns? Because we would be. Because this is exactly why war is bad. It is brutal, and there is no right way to do it. But because we're in this sort of gilded age idiocy, the members of the media talk about Syria. They talk about the Syrian government as if though they are conducting war the exact wrong way that we would never do, with this implication that we need to intervene and show these savages the right way to do war, which, of course, you know, the last time that we were in a large-scale occupation, we absolutely didn't go into Sadr City and kill a bunch of people. We, you know, didn't destroy civilians. We never massacred anyone. We never sieged a town. We never starved anyone out. But this sort of Edwardian moralistic short-sighted idiocy, it falls apart because they won't talk about Yemen, where there is just this incredibly deliberate and punitive and cruel and insane effort to starve out Yemeni civilians, the most vulnerable ones. And I don't know if that's because this is seen as something that's being conducted by Obama's NatSec blob, or that someone told them that this is a important thing that we should do, or that they, I think the most likely event is that they just honestly haven't thought about it that much. It's Syria is the one that everyone talks about. Yemen is the one that no one talks about. And for rank and file members of the media, and even like sort of mid-level editors, they're not very independent thinkers. And they're going to talk about the one they can do the most moral posturing on.
Now, getting back to sort of the internals of Saudi Arabia, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier as well, but do you see a route out here for Saudi? Is there a way that the U.S. both can untangle itself and also hopefully prevent the total meltdown of the region if Saudi Arabia implodes? Is there any sort of path for a stable transition? Because, you know, you had mentioned earlier this sort of obsession with pragmatism and the altar of the necessary evil. You know, is there, you know, because like I said, I am more of the mind, you know, and a certain former Democratic nominee for president of the United States has also privately expressed to me that he can't understand why the United States is continuing to align itself with Saudi Arabia instead of Syria, but I mean, instead of Iran. But, you know, with all these forces that are internally tearing Saudi Arabia apart, and it's an economy that's based on migrant workers, it's an economy that's based on oil, it has these meaningless make work programs for sort of the middle class, the royal upper class people. Yeah, they don't do anything. Although I think, though, but even the Beltway people, like a lot of them probably, if push came to shove, could find something to do with their skills, whereas my sense is that some of the Saudi folks, you know, especially in the civil service, literally just sit there, you know, playing solitaire all day or whatever on their computer. Like, I don't think they actually know how to do almost any of the work required. I mean, I'm sure there's some sort of a cadre that keeps the lights on, But beyond that, I mean, I think there's a lot of these, just these make work programs, and I don't know that they, you know, they don't have a culture of civic participation, let alone political participation. You know, by contrast, you look at, you know, the United Arab Emirates also has many of its own problems. They are very gradually introducing certain aspects of political participation and civic participation, very, very tightly controlled, but they are starting to introduce those steps. And there is a culture among the citizenship, at least, you know, setting aside the non-citizen population, which is extensive in the UAE, they are trying to build a culture of, like, you know, that you should care about your government and, you know, try to work toward good ideas and things like that. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, you know, they'll get these McKinsey reports or whatever, but it's all purely superficial. By contrast, you know, as we talked about, in Iran, despite all of Iran's problems, that's a country that has had some parliamentary type structures and things for quite a while. It has a very long standing, you know, centuries old, if not millennia old, sort of culture of what is Iran. I mean, it's changed somewhat, but there is an Iranian identity that is authentic in a way that is not true of, you know, the Saudi identity that was assembled in the early 20th century and revolves solely around the person of the monarchy. Whereas in Iran, you know, some people thought there was going to be total chaos, you know, when they got rid of the Shah in 79. In fact, things calmed down pretty quickly. I mean, they ended up, you know, locked in a war with their neighbor, but internally things calmed down relatively quickly and they were able to transition to a new system. And, you know, to my mind, at least, if we saw, you know, tomorrow, the total collapse of the sort of superstructure that sits on top of the Islamic Republic in Iran, you know, the supreme leader system, the Council of Guardians, that sort of thing, if that went away tomorrow, I think their constitution would kick in, the rest of it anyway. I think that their civic and political participation would kick in. They already know how to conduct elections and do that regularly. They have vibrant local governments, even if they're constrained. I think they would be fine. They would not go into a total tailspin and meltdown. I am having trouble seeing, and I wonder, you know, your thoughts on it, if there's a path out for Saudi Arabia that does not end in just a total vortex of doom, because if that is the path that it's going down, it's going to be hard to make that case to people that we shouldn't have this pragmatic approach of just continuing to bolster an increasingly sort of besieged monarchy within Saudi Arabia.
Well, I want to make clear that, you know, there isn't really a civic society, but it's not any fault of the Saudi people.
The
people that I talked to for my story were just incredibly courageous, had an incredible amount of solidarity with oppressed people all over the world. And they have every right in the world to only focus on their own situation, but they did not. Just an incredibly nice, courageous, optimistic, brave group of people. But if you look at what kind of society it is, the cards are quite stacked against them. You know, I think that obviously we can't do a whiplash severing of ties with Saudi Arabia for multiple reasons. It would be, you know, it would be kind of traumatic to their economy in a way that could create a lot of awful unrest, and you could end up with a group in charge that is more capricious, insane, cruel, and pious than the Saudis, which has always been kind of the fear of the U.S. NATSEC blob and the Saudi royal family themselves. Also, you know, if you want to get conspiratorial about the amount of jihadi groups that GID is on good terms with, and even on terms of command with, would you really want to immediately upset this group of people that much, where you are immediately saying, you know, no more, we're closing our embassy, we're doing this or doing that? You could see a lot of ugly strikes all over the world. You know, if you want to look at it from like the realpolitik angle, they wouldn't lack for a place to buy weapons from. They would just buy them from Russia. But I think a sort of a slow disengagement. In my ideal world, we slowly disengage from most of the relationships, pretty much all the relationships we have like this in the entire world. There's no reason for us to run targeting for other countries' bizarre regional wars that seem to have been created almost under the same circumstances as a dare or a bet that they lost, as it did the Saudi engagement in Yemen. Put every factor that is going into our involvement with Saudi Arabia and Yemen, who is it benefiting except for weapons contractors, who the Saudi war crimes get to serve as like kind of a trade show spectacle for the weapons that they make, and for high-ranking military officials who will probably end up on the boards of these corporations making millions of dollars after they retire while they're running these wars and recommending weapons to buy and sell and everything. But I think a slow disengagement from this sprawling, you know, people all often refer to us as an empire, but it's almost like we've involved a great portion of the world as extensions of our deep state. And many operations throughout the world are just these weird American deep state operations that happen to involve other countries. In my ideal world, we slowly disengage from that over the course of 10 years. I think that's, you can't do that too quick because, like I said, you can get this horrible whiplash effect where you make a million things you never intended on happening. But what does our involvement get the Saudis, even the people of Saudi Arabia? Are they more free now? Are their lives better? Are they set up for a better civil society one day? Do they have the building blocks for any type of representative government or rights to protect them from their government? Absolutely not. And being engaged with this, being engaged with a country like Saudi Arabia, it's caused us to turn a blind eye to some pretty nasty groups in the world. And we absolutely have blood on our hands for war crimes committed in Yemen, for war crimes committed in Syria, for, you know, war crimes we might see down the road in Chechnya. It's not something that you or I get any benefit out of, and it's certainly not anything that any Saudi, most people who live in Saudi Arabia get a benefit out of. It's not going to fix everything, but I think if you gave everyone the facts about what this is, what we were helping back up, and whether or not we have made things better for gay kids, immigrant, you know, migrant worker kids, for dissidents in Saudi Arabia, we absolutely haven't. And we're benefiting the highest level of each country's deep state, and for good cost of billions of dollars and creating a world of unintended consequences down the road. But yeah, I think a slow disengagement would be the best way to answer that.
My guest this hour has been Felix Biederman. Felix wrote an article, "Your App Isn't Helping the People of Saudi Arabia," and it's published at theconcourse.deadspin.com, and it was published in late December. So definitely go check out that. There's a lot more, particularly on the history of Saudi Arabia and how they got to where they are, you know, things like the Grand Mosque siege and things like that. Felix, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy to talk about your article.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Bill.
You can follow Felix at By Your Logic on Twitter. That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.